Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And tonight we're going to do some... We've got a great guest coming on, unfortunately, a little later tonight at 9:30 to 10. We've got Dr. Christopher Fitchner, who is the... He's an author who wrote a book called Cannabinomics. And...
Obviously, it's about marijuana.
About marijuana and the legalization of marijuana and the medical benefits for marijuana, as well as the activist movement that's out there right now and the progress they've made. And this is the legitimizing of marijuana for medical research or medical purposes and the benefits that...
It's really a holistic drug.
It's a very holistic drug, and... tremendous benefits from it, and we're going to play a video tonight on it as well. But I wanted to tonight first. That's coming up at 9:30. We got John Brennan joining us at 8:30 tonight. John is our
environmental
reporter. He's got a couple articles he wants to bring up, and we got Woody in the Ring, our sports reporter, coming on at a little around 9 o'clock.
At 9 o'clock. So we should have a pretty good lineup, and between now and then, we'll be bringing you news.
Yeah, and the news we're going to talk about tonight is I got a couple of very important video clips that I want to bring.
You'll obviously just be able to hear the audio part.
I think
the first one that's really, really important is one that was recorded quite a while ago.
Well, in 2007,
mm-hmm.
The former prime minister of Pakistan, Benazir Bhutto, stated on national television with an interview with David Frost that, and I saw this when it happened, I saw when it first came out, she said that she had evidence and was told by her intelligence officials that Bin Laden was dead. Assassinated.
So let's listen to what she has to say.
And that's just one of the verifications, and we have a number of others as well. And I'm gonna first thing I'm gonna play tonight is that it's 3 minutes long.
So this is
where she confirms that he's dead and what he was told. Now this is just about a week or two prior to her assassination.
That's right.
This is
Benazir Bhutto talking to David Frost about the death of Osama bin Laden, recorded in 2007.
Right.
Okay, let's go right to that.
Here we go.
And there was one report that said that you had arranged to send President Musharraf a letter to be sent in the event of your death by assassination, urging him to investigate certain individuals in his government. Is that true?
Yes, it is true that I wrote to General Musharraf. I received information from General Musharraf that a friendly country had passed on to them the information that I could be attacked by a gang from the Afghan warlord Baitullah Masood, or by Hamza bin Laden, the son of Osama bin Laden, or by the Pakistani Taliban in Islamabad, or by a group in Karachi. So I sent back a letter saying that while these groups may be used, I thought it was more important to go after the people who supported them, who organized them, who could possibly be the financiers or the organizers of the finance for those groups. And I named three individuals who I thought were their sympathizers. Now I understand that I could be wrong and my suspicions could be misplaced. But these are the people that I suspect want to stop the restoration of democracy. They want to stop my return because they know in 1993, when Pakistan was on the brink of being declared a terrorist state, I stopped the rise of terrorism. And they know that I can do it again. So So I feel that these are the forces that really want to stop not just me, but the democratic process and the will of the people from triumphing.
And in terms of these three people that you mentioned, were they members of or associated with the government?
Yes, well, one of them is a very key figure in security. He's a former military officer. He is someone that has had dealings with Jaish-e Mohammed, one of the banned groups of Maulana Azhar, who was in an Indian jail for decapitating three British tourists and three American tourists. And he also had dealings with Omar Sheikh, the man who murdered Osama bin Laden. Now, I know that having dealings with people does not necessarily mean direct evidence, but I also know that internal security has totally collapsed in Pakistan and that internal security cannot collapse without there being some blind eye, if not collusion, being turned to the rise of the militants and militancy. Not only are our tribal areas out of our control, but even the beautiful valley of Swat is now under takeover by Islamists. So I would like to see a Park-led police inquiry assisted by Scotland Yard or the FBI come in, use their forensic and scientific explanation to find out not only the perpetrators, but the financiers and the organizers of this heinous crime that killed 158 innocent people.
I want to go back a little bit. And
where she said that again.
Where she said
and,
that.
And I noticed
American
that Robert Frost, Robert Frost, David Frost didn't pick it up.
Jaish-e Mohammed, one of the very key figures
in
security. He's a former military officer. He is someone that has had dealings with Jaish-e Mohammed, one of the banned groups of Maulana Azhar, who was in an Indian jail for decapitating three British tourists and three American tourists. And he also had dealings with Omar Sheikh, the man who murdered Osama bin Laden. Now, I know that having dealings with people does not necessarily mean direct evidence.
Oh, Don, I wanted to stop that.
Oh, they got the point.
Evidence, but I also know that internal security has totally collapsed. Military officer, he is someone that has had dealings with Jaish-e Mohammed, one of the banned groups of Maulana Azhar, who was in an Indian jail for decapitating three British tourists and three American tourists. And he also had dealings with Omar Sheikh, the man who murdered Osama bin Laden. Now I know that having dealings with people.
So you heard that. You got a chance to hear it three times. The man who murdered Osama bin Laden. Now, Benazir Bhutto, she was had the inside track. She would have no reason to lie, and it just came out. And she wasn't even talking about Osama bin Laden. That was an aside to what she was talking about.
Bhutto didn't mean to say Osama bin Laden.
Bhutto. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's a recap. But anyway, let's go on to...
So let's talk a little bit more about some of the other articles that are out. There are several...
I was just looking at a bunch of these things.
Several other people have written things about this supposed death of Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And certainly Alex Jones has been talking about it nonstop on his show.
Yep.
It was such a staged event.
I think it was important to
made,
hear that.
Made for TV.
Only problem, here, this is the Alex Jones one, but it's 14 minutes.
It's very difficult to understand. He's interviewing General Hamid Gul, and his accent is very heavy. And
he was the chief IS intelligence officer for Pakistan, and he's saying that it was all choreographed.
Yeah.
And you know, it was
made for TV drama.
He's been dead forever.
And supposedly they had him on.
Actually, why don't you listen to the Alex Jones for just a minute? We'll just put it on for a few minutes because he explained it at the beginning.
Yeah, that part
is
good.
How many times Osama bin Laden's been declared dead.
I just listened to the beginning of this, folks.
Yep.
So, folks, they think you're so dumb that they produced a fake bin Laden photo and gave it to the newspapers, and the newspapers all ran with a Photoshop the government had already put out 3 years ago of him with, you know, bullet holes in his head and his face all smashed in. And they know emotionally people needed to see the dead body. You know, habeas corpus goes back not just to show the body. If you're going to go to jail for something, they need evidence of it. Show the person you killed. It even predates that in a dual way that if the king said there's a bounty on this person, you had to bring the body. Bring him in, dead or alive, but bring the body. Bring the body strapped over the horse or you don't get the bounty. But you notice in this dead or alive, we don't get to see it. Now, you know, like Mussolini being hauled up in Rome by his feet to be spit on for 3 days by hundreds of thousands of people, or Ceausescu, you know, you want to see the body. We saw Saddam hung. He was in a prison for a year in front of everybody. Where is the body? Where is the body? Where is the body? No, we're not being shown that. He's thrown into the ocean. And I told Kurt Nimmo last night, I said, we need a part in the article about where is his body? And conveniently, they're thrown in the ocean. Now, joining us from Pakistan, and we'll find out how close to where this reportedly happened outside one of their largest cities, is General Hamid Ghul, retired Pakistani Army general, served as the Director General of Pakistan's Inner Service Intelligence. He was instrumental in the anti-Soviet support of Mujahideen in the Afghan War in 79 to 89. And he was also a veteran of a war with India as a ground soldier. And we appreciate Hamid Ghul joining us.
Yeah, it's a good interview, but you have to listen very, very carefully.
Go to a thick accent.
Go
to Infowars.com and check that out. It's 15 minutes.
And it's worth listening to.
Very much worth it. So, just to let you know that that's what's going on. We don't believe Osama is dead. All right, he's dead, but he's been dead for 10 years. All right, he died in 2002.
He was a very ill man.
He
had kidney disease.
Yeah, he was.
And,
yeah.
I think it was kidney disease.
Yeah, he had kidney disease.
Yeah, he was very, very sick. He really
needed a transplant. He was on dialysis, so he might have gotten a transplant. Who knows? But, you know, the thing is that, you know, he was supposedly, we've seen this, we've talked about it on our show, and we've brought this up time and again. And the last time they said that they had killed him was, you know, they showed three pictures of him, you know?
Okay, so let's...
I think that's even on here. I think I got that.
Yeah, they might.
There it is. Death of bin Laden means terrorism will go nuclear. Okay? Bin Laden, this bin Laden is dead bullshit could scare the pants off every intelligent human being who has been paying serious attention over the last few years. Nearly every news bulletin and current affairs program will be endlessly asking the question, will Al-Qaeda take revenge for the killing of bin Laden when they, the CIA, Mossad, MI6, as usual, strike. The familiar traitors will be wheeled onto our screens, so say, we told you so. Pray to God this is wrong, but it's hard to see any other consequence of today's news, nor any other reason for the CIA to go to all the trouble to carry out this operation, concoct this lying story to go with it, when everybody knows, outside of the idiot zone, that bin Laden is already a long time dead.
Let's
the
rest of this.
Yep. And this is by Ken Boyle. Kev Boyle, rather.
Yeah.
And it says, where is it?
Osama bin Laden was introduced to us all as a central player in the narrative that brought us the war on territory. It is important to understand that history is carefully scripted in advance by agencies of international finance capital. It doesn't matter if the narrative is true or false. Actually, the war on terror is, in all important aspects, false. What is important is that we, the dumb masses, are given a good story in which to believe. It's all about the narrative. Well, now that the central baddie no longer has a role to play in a narrative, we can surely expect that the globalist storytellers are ready with the new script. What seasoned CIA watchers will sensibly ask, and what everyone else would be wise to start asking then, is this. Does the death of bin Laden today signal a summer of nuclear terrorism in the United States? The chaos is mounting. International law is now a joke, a dead duck. The Middle East has been turned more than ever before into a seething cauldron. China is sitting back for now while it watches its investments in eastern Libya turn to dust. It understands that the West is determined to drive it out of Africa. Russia watches while Syria and its deal with the Syrians to establish a naval base in the Mediterranean falls apart. China is beginning to refuse to buy American debt, so the dollar will shortly collapse. What better event to coincide with financial collapse than the act of nuclear terrorism at home? Immediate war footing would guarantee immediate recovery of the currency, albeit possibly a new one. This bin Laden is dead bullshit should scare the pants off every intelligent human being who has been paying serious attention over the last few years. Nearly every news bulletin and current affairs program will be endlessly asking the question, will al-Qaeda take revenge for the killing of bin Laden? When they, the CIA, Mossad, MI6, as usual, strike, the familiar traitors will be wheeled to our screens to say, we told you so.
To the extent to which the theater of the coming conflict is coordinated between Western powers, China, Russia, is unknown. However, it is looking increasingly like we are watching a full-on world war in the making. The fact that nobody wants this yet, it seems to be coming, tells us yet again, if we still need telling, that our elected governments act in the interest of parties other than ourselves. Therefore, our government is the primary enemy of we the people.
It seems unbelievable, but there you are. Henry Mackow appears to deliver the only commentary that makes any sense of such breathtaking reality. Humanity has been hijacked. Henry, you're right. By a Luciferian cult, as you assert. More than likely. Let men gather before their God. We know that the media will continue to lie, even though those lies spell the same disaster for the journalists who tell them for the rest of us.
Prayers are recommended. We are soon to endure a great trauma. The sooner we find faith and recognize that we are all one, single powerful rather than passive consciousness created by God, the sooner we will overcome the manipulative fiends that have blinded the lies and misled the minds of humanity and brought the souls of so many of our tragically weak leaders.
By the way, and see here, it says, article from India's Daily Backshot.com, WikiLeaks, nuclear hellstorm if Osama is caught or killed, says al-Qaeda.
Now, this thing is from Wayne Madsen. It's 12 minutes old. But Wayne is good. But that's, Ben Lee lookalike. Looks like staged.
Bin Laden death looks like it's, yeah, he's right.
Let's go on for that.
Yeah, that's 7 minutes, that one.
Let's
just play a little bit of it. This is Wayne Madsen. He's really good.
My mind is reeling right now. It is spinning. You have within 30 minutes of the bin Laden announcement, when they were just saying Obama will make the announcement, and my phone began ringing off the hook, you have these spontaneous Democratic supporters with crisp American flags showing up in the hundreds to worship Obama, our great hardcore leader. Now we have people spontaneously reportedly putting flowers at Bush's mansion in Dallas, President Bush, worshiping him for saving us.
You have basically repeats of Chalabi, the globalist frontman, in the fake pull-down of the Saddam statue, where the national news only showed up close. Later, photos got released. There was like 20 people around the statue, but they said hundreds of thousands are there. They pulled down the statue. Basically, we've all seen Baghdad Bob up there saying the Americans are not invading the city, as you can see explosions behind him. Our government does the same kind of stuff. They just get away with it.
Yeah.
They never get in trouble
for it.
And this whole thing is a giant, disgusting psyop. You notice in the last month, though, if Bin Laden gets killed, Al-Qaeda's going to hit. We saw WikiLeaks put that out. AP put that out. There's 160 nukes buried in America. Totally ridiculous. That's like saying there's 160 leprechauns, you know, at the end of rainbows. But they are really getting everybody ready with the same preparatory fear-mongering I saw before 9/11. Wayne, are they getting ready to stage new terror attacks? Taliban commander vows to avenge Bin Laden in America. Now we've got to let the TSA stick their hands down six-year-old's pants, or Al-Qaeda will get us, Wayne?
Oh, well, that's what we're hearing. You know, people are saying, well, now can we bring our troops home from Iraq and Afghanistan? Can we, you know, get rid of the Patriot Act? They said, no, we need this stuff more now than ever, because we're going to be retaliated against by Al-Qaeda. And, you know, I also would point out, remember Bush, they was asked about Bin Laden. He said, Bin Laden, I'm not worried about Bin Laden. I mean, it was clear, even Bush said he wasn't even worried about this guy after a couple of years.
Well, he knew he was dead.
We're back live. The Atlantic and others are attacking me, Jeffrey Goldberg. The warp speed rise of deatherism. And they're quoting my interviews here with high-level globalist CFR members that Bin Laden was dead many, many years ago, 9 years ago, nine-plus years ago. And now you notice that Panetta is leaving. Last week they announced leaving the CIA to go to the Pentagon. Petraeus to fix intelligence is going to the CIA. And Panetta is the big hero. Man, they did this. They took out Bin Laden. This could not be more staged. And they're also positioning Petraeus for the presidential run. Let's talk about that. And then also the Al-Qaeda commanders. Anwar al-Awlaki, they tell us, is number two. But also number two is Adam Gadon, former Mr. Perlman, whose granddaddy ran the ADL. He was arrested once for beating up Muslims outside mosque. He hated them so much. But then he joined Al-Qaeda so he could be the pretext to put out videos, uploaded in the same video layer as the Intel Center video, showing they're the ones putting it out. I mean, this is some bold psyops, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, Panetta, who was not really liked at the CIA, yes, this gets puts a big feather in old Joe Camel's hat there when he goes over to the Pentagon. there's just too many things involved with this. So they decided that they had to, defrost Bin Laden. And but look, nobody got an eyeball on his body. Like I say, there was nothing on NSA intercepts, and they have that area well covered, indicating there was an operation going on to get Bin Laden. Obama tried to say, well, we weren't sure, but I authorized this when we had good intelligence. I mean, who's he fooling? He hasn't. He doesn't tell the truth about anything. If President Obama told me it was a nice day, I'd have to, you know, put my head out the window and get my own opinion of that. But now I see that they're trying to spin this NSA story, because now they're saying what got NSA interested in that particular house was the fact there were no cell phones or any communications coming out of there like all the other houses in the area, and that's why they thought it was suspicious. So it looks like they're trying to cover themselves by saying it was a communications dead zone just in that one house that turned out to be, that's supposedly where Bin Laden was staying.
So you've got the same breakdown. I mean, I knew it as soon as I heard it last night, but today, Al-Qaeda's about to hit, give all your rights up, never mind the foreign banks looting you, the dollar dying, gas prices. We killed Bin Laden, but we got to take all your rights because they're about to retaliate.
And the rest of you.
Oh, I think so. I think this is, you know, they're just playing everybody in this country and elsewhere. I mean, did you see Tony Blair was on there patting him? He almost broke his arm patting himself on the back. saying this was a great day. as they've seen this great PSYOP, this great Wag the Dog Hollywood-made feature come to the small screen, and they're just tripping over themselves, trying to praise one another and themselves.
Well, Wayne Madsen, I'm going to come back and take some calls for military folks to get their view on this. I'll try to calmly recap just all the incredible evidence of how ridiculous this is. But as Joseph Goebbels said, good, effective propaganda is simple and something that people want to buy into. And, you know, who likes Osama bin Laden? So it's, oh, my gosh, he's dead. Isn't that great? This is so ridiculous, and it's also frightening. It signifies the escalation in events that we're now entering. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I think, and I agree, we may see the worst yet to come with all this noise about retaliation now. Everybody's talking about it on the corporate media.
Wayne Madsen, Report.com or Infowars.com. Thank you so much, Wayne, for joining us. We'll talk to you again soon.
Good to be with you, Alex.
You bet.
Yeah, they're absolutely right. That's one thing that really frightens me is the talk of retaliation.
Absolutely.
Since we've had, what, two soap operas closed during the day, this is going to be the new drama that'll be on all the time, all day. You know, Americans love reality TV, so now we're having war reality TV. And in the meantime, your rights will be chopped and your taxes will go up even more.
Let's see if we have time to read this one. This is, I don't know if this is...
We only have 4 minutes until our environmental guest, John Brennan,
comes on. I love this one. Wannabe expert claims healthy eating is a mental disorder. And
smartphones, the tracking and surveillance of millions of Americans.
Yeah. And let's see. Recent revelations that Apple and iPhone and iPad, Google's Android and Microsoft's Windows Phone 7 operating systems collect, store, and transmit records of users' physical locations to central databases secretly and without consent have ignited a firestorm over Americans' privacy rights in the age of hyper-surveillance. And with a lawsuit filed last week in U.S. District Court in Florida by two iPhone users, the Register reports Apple guru Steve Jobs was forced to respond to complaints after the firm's usual tactic, deafening silence, failed to assuage customers' anxieties. Assuage customers' anxieties, right? And let me quote you. You know what I want to say? So many horrible things, but that one about where is it? Where is that?
I don't know what you're talking about, Leo. One about what?
The suicide of Apple workers there.
That wasn't too far down in the list. No, it wasn't that far. Yeah, in China, you know, they've made iPod and Apple manufacturers, the people that work in the plants, to sign contracts that say that they won't commit suicide. I guess the working conditions are just horrific, and people are committing suicide right and left.
Yep.
It's
because of the working conditions, right? And,
I'd like to know why Apple doesn't respond to that.
Yeah, factory workers, factories making sought-after Apple iPads and iPhones in China are forcing staff to sign pledges not to commit suicide, an investigation has revealed. At least 14 workers at Foxconn factories in China have killed themselves in the last 16 months as a result of horrendous working conditions. Many more have believed to have either survived attempts or been stopped before trying at Apple suppliers plants in Gangju or Shenzhen. And after a spat of suicides last year, managers of the factories ordered new staff to sign pledges that they would not attempt to kill themselves.
Well, let's
like
just
that.
Jump down to this. This is why they were killing themselves. Excessive overtime was rife.
But the investigation of 500,000 workers at the Center of Research in Multiple Companies, corporate misbehavior and appalling conditions in the factories.
This is what they found. They found excessive overtime despite a legal limit of 36 hours a month. One pay slip showed a worker did 98 hours of overtime in 1 month. During peak periods of demand for the iPad, workers were made to take only 1 day off in 13. badly performing workers were humiliated in front of colleagues. Workers are banned from talking and are made to stand up for their 12-hour shifts.
My
imagine
God.
Standing up for 12-hour shifts.
This is Apple. Okay, the anti-suicide pledge was brought in after sociologists wrote an open letter to the media calling for the end of the restrictive working practices. But the investigation revealed many of the workers still lived in dismal conditions, with some only going home to see family once a year. One worker told the newspaper, "Sometimes my roommates cry when they arrive in the dormitory after a long day." She said that they were made to work illegally long hours for a basic daily wage, as little as five yen or something, whatever.
5.20 pounds, it looks like. But it must be
yen, I think, or something. And that workers were housed in dormitories of up to 24 people a room. In Chengdu, working between 60 and 80 hours overtime a month was normal, with many breaching Apple's own code of conduct with the length of their shifts. And the investigations found that employees claimed they were not allowed to speak to each other. Foxconn admits that it breaks overtime laws, but claims all the overtime is voluntary.
Yeah, right.
Some officials within the company even accused workers of committing suicide to secure large compensation payments for their families. Anti-suicide nets were put up around the dormitory buildings on the advice of psychologists. Foxconn said that it had faced some very challenging months for everyone associated with Foxconn families because of the suicides. And this goes on. But conditions are harsh and they don't have a social life. Their life is worth just working in the factory, and that is it. Demands for iPads and iPhones has soared, resulting in tough targets for workers in Apple factories. Apple suppliers' code of conduct demands that employees are treated with respect and dignity, but its own audit reports suggest suppliers in China may not meet up to these standards.
Uh-huh.
All right, the global high-tech product manufacturer made profits of 6 billion ni the first quarter. I don't know what ni is, but I guess that's Chinese money. But anyway, I thought you'd like to know. And let's see, we may have John on the line.
We have to go back from our news
here
to the main switchboard. Let's go back to our switchboard. Blog Talk Radio switchboard, Leo.
I was going there, but I don't know where it is. There it is. All right. And, you know, John hasn't called in yet. So let's go back to the news. All right.
The four flights of 9/11, what happened to the passengers?
Most people are not aware that these are issues with the four groups of people who flew on the four flights of 9/11 from three locations. There are so many issues it would take a newsroom full of dedicated reporters a long time to sift through it all. There are problems with the boarding of passengers on three flights, and on the fourth flight we find two boardings, an unusual event to say the least. Two of the aircraft we are to believe didn't even take off on 9/11, as this is what registers with the BTS database for flights 1177 on 9/11. Two of the aircraft that allegedly struck the towers can be plausibly shown to be drones, calling into question both passengers and crews from those respective flights. While Flight 77 obviously didn't crash at the Pentagon, from all evidence shown, Flight 77 is one of the two flights which BTS shows no departure time for.
While Flight 93 wasn't even a regular flight on 9/11, it was created in the last 2 hours before it flew. And as you will see, are good reasons to believe Flight 93 was boarded twice at Newark. If this sounds confusing, it's because it was meant to be so. But I believe this article shows it is possible to make some simple sense out of the day's events and tie them all together. Now you can go to this article. I found it not as good as what I thought it was going
to
be.
They have to
be,
yeah.
And I didn't really have time to. The BTS is who keeps the statistics. So I think that's an important thing to know, that there's a lot of discrepancies. So, and a lot of problems with what they're saying. And certainly today is a good time to bring that up.
There was one other that I wanted to read. We want us to read. It was that the one on the school system there. Do you want to read that one?
Oh, yeah, on the testing.
Yeah.
That's quite a good article.
Israeli jets prepare in Iraq to strike Iran. That's coming soon.
Yeah, Bahraini forces
abduct
school kids.
Saudi-backed Bahraini forces have attacked a number of schools across the Persian Gulf Kingdom, abducting several students, witnesses say. Bahraini forces took away two students with a school in the capital of Manama and eight others from a school in the northwest eastern town of whatever. Security forces also snatched a wounded anti-government protester. So they're kidnapping kids in Bahrain, the fucked up town, fucked up city, fucked up country, and used to continue to fight, we're going to continue to fight Al-Qaeda, says Hillary.
I was looking for a particular article, but it's not that far down. It's the one on the school kids.
Real audio.
Kate and William, real audio. Royal wedding, real audio. I don't know what that is.
Probably a protest. It's really going on.
Topic, so I'm trying to figure something a little different, maybe.
Okay.
I probably have just more or less a few comments tonight more than anything else.
Okay.
I know you've probably covered the Bin Laden situation pretty well.
Yeah, we focused mainly on that because it was such an upsetting thing to us, the way it's being presented by the mass media, by the corporate media. Setting us up and getting us ready for whatever the next event is.
Or event.
Planned, I guess.
Yeah, it won't be an event. They more or less said on the. They usually tell you if you know how to listen to how the how Big Brother speaks through its mouthpiece, radio personalities, even on CNN. They basically have told us that you'll have payback for this killing, and it won't be as big as 9/11, it'll be a series of small, horrible atrocities. So that's what we have to look forward to, is my guess.
And it won't be, and of course it will be by the Mossad and by the CIA and by the MI6. And
it'll be Al-Qaeda, otherwise known as Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
But you'll be given the treatment of slaves by your own military and police. It'll be the equivalent of an unwritten Patriot Act, or it'll be the Patriot Act brought to life, brought to the surface, whatever you want to look at it, like you've never seen it before, for your safety, of course.
Oh, yeah, for your own good.
Yeah, and everybody should really try and go online and look up the video, George Orwell's 1984. It's ironic to think that was, the book was written by... The guy's name was actually Eric Blair. His book, his pseudonym was George Orwell, and he was a very high high-ranking Freemason. He had privy knowledge to what was coming in the future. It wasn't just a guess. And it's the same with the Huxleys, Aldous Huxley, you know, Brave New World. These are all just ways of getting it out of their system and putting it right in our face, telling us what's coming, because it all comes to fruition. It all happens one day. But now getting back to...
84, which was a long time ago. But you know, he was off by 25 years or so.
Yeah, nonetheless, everything that they basically, you know, the terrorism, in the George Orwell 1984, Emmanuel Goldstein is the perpetual terrorist, or the bad guy. That's Osama bin Laden. See, those two names keep, I'm mixing them up. The local radio station mixed it up today. It has to be quite deliberate, the more I think about this.
I think, John, probably a good indication of what will happen will be on the deck of cards.
Oh, you know, I've got to go check the cutting edge. Was it what it was called? Steve
yeah.
Jacobson?
Yeah, I think I.
No, Bay, David Bay, and cuttingedge.org.
Cuttingedge.org, yes, Steve.
I checked the cards last a couple of weeks ago. Remember I mentioned it?
Yes.
And I checked it, and what it was the card after
9/11.
After the tower was the biohazard war.
Well, of course, we had Fukushima in Japan, interestingly enough, recently.
That's what I mean. That's why I checked it, because we had that. And I wanted to see what it was, and it was radiation and biochemical
warfare,
basically. Yeah.
And I just want to say here, just in case there's people who don't know what we're talking about, there is a game similar to a Monopoly game that you can buy in the stores. It came out in, I think, 1992, 1995, well before the events of 9/11. And in this card game, let's say it's not a card game, it's a Monopoly game using cards and other game parts.
Monopoly where you're gaining power.
Right,
you know?
And in this board game, it's called Illuminati, The New World Order. And you could probably still buy the game. I do know a guy here who has one locally. He's told me I can have it. I really would like to. I think it's on YouTube. If you just type that into a YouTube search engine somewhere, you just put Illuminati New World Order board game, you will see exactly what's on there. And it's quite frightening to think that it appears everything that's happened or everything that was put into that game is coming to reality. And it's not by pure fluke. It's because Steve, the guy who invented the game, obviously, just like George Orwell, had this...
had the inside track.
Well, they're bubbling to tell you. It's kind of like in their satanic religion, which is what they are, they get brownie points for telling you what's happening, but they kind of look at it like, here, we're telling you what we're doing and we're going to do, and you're so darn stupid, like sheep, you don't even still get it. And they get a bigger laugh out of making fools out of us as we... you know, go into this new society. We're entering the New World Order type society where eventually we're heading for the cashless society, the microchip population, and the total loss of our freedoms in a total world socialism state or fascist state, whatever you want to call it.
A fascist state, yeah, definitely. But no, we're dealing with something really serious and ugly coming up. And like the last card, to be played was the bioterror weapon.
Yeah.
I just want a quick comment here. I'm going off topic again. Regarding the bin Laden capture, there's a lot of inconsistencies in that whole story because, I'm just going to go through it very briefly here. Let's see now. They helicoptered in the Navy SEALs with no resistance.
They find
the room he's in with no resistance either. They find him unarmed and apparently unguarded. They shoot him and his wife and some kids and women. They drag his body out, still with no resistance. They pack the body into the chopper I mean, I presume that's how they did it. They fly off still with no resistance. They take some DNA. They send it off to be tested from the chopper, which is kind of odd. Then they fly his body 1,500 miles to an aircraft carrier in the Arabian Sea. And they weigh
him overboard.
And yeah, and they weigh him down and they dump him overboard. Right. Now, am I missing anything here? I want to see a kind of a timeline here. Americans apparently are watching too much TV and movies. I still get people telling me about The Great Escape, that it's a true story. And, of course, it's nonsense. It's a novel. So, you know, basically it's hard to have sympathy for the sheep out there who are falling for this nonsense. But we've had 9 other reports over the last 6 years at least, including Madeleine Albright talking about the fact that Osama bin Laden was deceased.
Well, you know the interesting thing. Not only was Madeleine Albright, yeah, but Bhutto said it. We played that clip, and then tonight, and also something that came up, and I remember it so well. Was back because I mentioned it on the show that year, and it was in 2007. At the same time, Bhutto made that remark that he was dead. But there was a special CIA, if you will, group that was targeting, that was surveilling Bin Laden, trying to find Bin Laden, and that publicly was. Publicly, but the guys that were in it, there was like 7 or 8 men that were assigned to track to try to find Osama bin Laden through every possible means, right? In the CIA. And what happened was, and this I will never forget it because I heard it on NPR, and I believe it was NPR, they were talking about the dismantling of that group, all right, in the CIA, and this was in 2007, and they one of the members of the group was really upset about it and said, why, you know, he came out, he became a whistleblower, and he says, you know, why are they dismantling this Osama bin Laden group? We're the only ones who are searching for this guy, all right, and yet they're you know, we've been doing it for, you know, 8 years or 5 years or whatever, and he says, and we finally. We're trying to make headway on it, and he says now they're, but he says we haven't found anything, but at the same time they decided to dismantle it. So nobody's looking for Obama. Now all of a sudden, what?
Osama.
5-4 Osama. But now, 3 years later, 4 years later, all of a sudden Osama bin Laden is dead. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense to you or no?
No, it's just it
makes no sense
for timeline.
Well, we agree with that, though.
So, but I mean, it's just like Alex Jones says. He says they got to think the American people are completely and absolutely stupid.
And I'm
beginning to believe maybe 2/3 of them are, or 3/4 of them are.
There's a lot that aren't. The other thing that really bothered me is the what they're playing on the corporate media, the celebration of somebody's death.
Yeah.
You know, with the people jumping around and draping themselves in flags and just...
We're talking about barbarism at its highest.
Horrible.
You know, we're talking about the Romans.
And
in
disrespectful to human life,
in
I
the
think.
Colosseum, you know, you know.
Why
yeah.
be, you know,
and
to
just,
celebrate killing someone. And the guy was obviously unarmed. He was... You know, that they didn't
with no resistance.
With no resistance,
yeah, yeah,
so they shot him.
Right.
Well, it's only a story, of course.
What?
It's only a story because I mean, obviously.
Well, we realize that, but wouldn't you think they'd have a better story than that?
Yeah, but and it is very sad, like you said, that the public are completely in a trance, basically. You know, and it's not their fault. They've been intergenerationally lured into this trance. Called
yeah.
reality or false reality. Any people at this stage who have not gotten a grasp of the true events of 9/11 are, I mean, pretty sad.
Yeah.
They probably never will.
They never will. And their whole lives are going to
well, they've just been so brainwashed, Neil.
They're idiots. I mean,
not necessarily. Subjected to the mass media, and they've fallen for it.
And they're idiots.
Just stop. I don't necessarily agree with that. You were an idiot up until a few years ago, and so was I. So, you know,
I believe he was a piece of crap.
Leo, you're not listening. We were brainwashed in other ways.
Oh.
You know, just not in that way, because we woke up. We were brainwashed before that. Hopefully, a lot of other people will wake up. So were you. You fell for everything a lot longer than I did. And I'm sure John was up until a point. We all have been.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't you agree, John?
But after 10 years.
That we've all been brainwashed up to a point, and some of us have been lucky and awakened.
Yeah, television is an amazing brainwashing device.
Oh, it is. Terrible.
In fact, it's funny, I just realized something. I did have a YouTube piece to play on that whole subject of how television, I think it's referred to the people in the video, called it the boob tube. And it's a guy from Great Britain, England, talking about how it has taken over our psyche. I could probably pull it up here, although my audio won't be as good because my main speakers are down. Would that be something you'd be interested in listening to?
Yeah, well, we got 10 minutes.
We have about 10 minutes. How long is it, John?
It probably is quite a bit longer. Again, changing.
Maybe just refer people to that.
Yeah, I think I can't pull it up right now. If I take what I got on my screen here, I'll skip it. Just forget I said that for the moment.
Okay.
I didn't realize that only 10 minutes, so it's going to be too.
Too long.
Easy to go scouring around looking for that and getting the name. But I do have a story here. Like you introduced me as the environmental guy, which I usually do stories on chemtrails, and I try and keep an eye on what's going on. I don't know if you heard about the tornadoes that touched down on May 3rd in New Zealand.
No, I didn't hear about those.
Very, very rare, if ever it has happened. A tornado ripped through a busy shopping center in the north Auckland suburb of Albany on May 3rd, leaving a trail of damage and debris. Weather warnings for Auckland were lifted several hours after the tornado hit the Met Service, but Met Service said the bad weather was moving south. The Prime Minister, John Key, earlier told the media he had received advice that two people had died as a result of the tornado. But Waitakere Police District Commander Gary Davey would confirm only one fatality. Mr. Davey said he believed that number to be accurate. Mr. Kay said it's been a very powerful and very devastating tornado that's caused a significant amount of damage in a very localized area. He said that information was patchy and work was still going on to establish the level of destruction as well as what risks still existed from damaged buildings. The MP for Northcore, Minister Jonathan Coleman, is going up this evening, and I'll obviously monitor the situation to see what else the government might be able to do, he said. Mr. Key said he had left a message for the Auckland Mayor Len Brown offering government support. Most of the injuries are believed to be minor, and the witnesses say the body of a man in his 30s was found in the old Placemakers car park near the shopping center. This is obviously a local story I'm reading. Helicopter would map the tornado's path. The rumbling, they said, kept getting louder and louder. Helena Campbell was working in Pack and Save when the tornado hit Albany, and that's in New Zealand and not Albany, New York. She said, I heard a loud rumbling, which I thought was thunder. It kept getting louder and louder. We thought it was another earthquake. She said, when staff and customers ran out into the car park, they saw debris everywhere. And she noticed her car was missing. It was soon located in the car park of an abandoned Placemakers building nearby. I'm in a bit of shock, really, she said. It shows the power of tornadoes. Again, these strange weather patterns, we all know of the tornadoes that touched down across the south last week.
Mm-hmm.
A week before, the time is going by here. I can't keep account of all the stuff that's going on. It was the day before the before the royal wedding.
Yep.
And, you know, people are really gone. That video you played with the sheep going, meh, meh. It's very true because people are in that state, generally speaking. I mean, I can understand the British being glued to it, but what bothered me the next day was with that devastation of those tornadoes, CNN, following night, gave 99%, and not just CNN, a lot of the major stations, 99% of its focus on the royal wedding.
The morning of the wedding, every single channel had that.
Yes, and we had people in the south that was the worst tornado touchdowns. I mean, this is on a scale possibly larger scale or as big anyway as what happened in Hurricane Katrina. More savage. Floods are one thing, but when a tornado is taking down steel-framed buildings and literally shearing them off like a lawnmower, sending them flying into the sky, coming down anywhere and killing people, 300 people obliterated, probably in a very nasty way. They didn't show many of the bodies, and we probably don't see them anyway. But it just shows you how the media, they're just saying to you again, we don't care about you Americans anymore. I personally, after studying all this weather modification phenomena, it's almost as if they're using the chemtrails to load the atmosphere up like it's a weapon. Let's get the pressure up, right, and then they just unleash it. And I really think they're at the stage now where they're using tornadoes as a weapon, and they're still at the test stage. But it's scary to think that this will become coming our way probably to Connecticut soon. At the Northeast, I mean, they've already had movies about tornadoes hitting New York City. Only in the movies, but it always starts there first to kind of get your mind set around.
Oh, really?
It's called predictive programming.
You there, John?
Yes. Hello? Did you lose me?
John?
Yes, go back to the switchboard.
Hello? 1-2. Hello?
Let us check our switchboard. Wait, somehow. John's there. Hey,
I'm
John?
Here. Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. We just didn't hear you a minute ago. We thought maybe you got disconnected. You all right?
No, I haven't touched anything, so somebody else didn't like what I was saying, perhaps.
Okay.
Well, you know, I think it was interesting that you said that in some of the films that the tornado started in New York City.
A tornado hits New York City. I can't remember the name of the movie, but there is a movie that was basically that's the scenario.
You're beginning to think that the chemtrails have something to do with loading up the atmosphere with energy or creating an atmosphere of energy, and then you just throw something in that turns the switch and then you have whatever it is they want to create.
Right. I don't know how the system works, but partly the chemtrails are basically able to change the pressure in the atmosphere. Clouds work as an atmospheric thermostat for the whole planet. They've obviously got some way of creating almost like a vortex in the atmosphere, and they're able to, I think, target it more clearly now. It used to be we only have tornadoes, and there may be natural events, which is how they learned to do this. So don't get me wrong. Not all tornadoes since the beginning of time have been created by military forces and weaponized. The military, even on the History Channel, this is admitted, the military has been using people to study lightning. They knew lightning is a natural thing. They just didn't know what triggered it. Well, if you go on that the History Channel, they did a show called That's Impossible, Weather Warfare.
Mm-hmm.
Watch it carefully and slowly and play it back a few times. If you listen carefully, I just watched it recently. They do actually say their military is not currently using it, but they sure would like to have it, and one day they expect it to be part of their arsenal. So given that sort of information, it's kind of like people still...
Not much of a leap, is it, John, to figure it out?
Oh, no. In this day and age, you know, people don't understand. It's like the average person doesn't know how their iPhone works or what's inside the little computers we use, but the big powers that be do. It doesn't matter that we don't know. They know. They can use the technology that's 50 years ahead. We're always kept like mushrooms in the dark anyway. We're like in the dark ages compared to what's available out there. So the weather as a weapon You can look up that phrase on Google. People who are laughing out there at me, perhaps, put in weather as a weapon. See what comes up. Look at all the articles. Look at 14 pro and 14, against, whatever you want. You'll discover there are plenty of guys out there toying around with that. It would be way bigger than the atomic bomb. It's the ultimate weapon, and you have plausible deniability. So I think what they're doing is now they're getting sort of like crazy lustful to see how much more havoc they can cause. And the public is so stupid, literally, and you hate to say that, but they are, that they are just believing it's normal. And, 300 tornadoes just touched down and wiped out everybody in the county. Oh, well, I guess that's normal in the middle of springtime when there's no really hot weather,
Yeah, they don't even think about it, John.
Yeah, so it is a scary time we're living in. I don't want to keep people in fear, but if tornadoes should come onto the horizon and we get it on our radios, really, really take it seriously.
Yeah, you should go to the lowest point that you have in your house.
Well, probably get away from anything that can, lowest point in your house if you're in an area like a house. But if you're in a park or something, just get away from the trees and stuff. Just keep out.
And also go to the lowest point if there's a ditch or the tornado could go across the ditch and not get you. You want to be in a low, if you're in an open spot, you want to get in the lowest possible point that you can find.
That is correct. It's sad that they're getting away with this, but the people who haven't seen the chemtrails and don't understand, they'll never will understand. It'll be just like, the 9/11 events. The weather will wipe some people's houses off the map, and they'll just say, oh, well, it must have been God. certainly there's natural weather, but God, who created the weather, if you believe in God, has a hell of a lot of help out there electronically with the HAARP systems and the...
Here's something here, John. It backs up what you're saying. There's an article by Natural News, and it says 14 signs the collapse of our modern world has begun. And one of them is tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, and tsunamis. At first it seemed like a fluke, but now it's a pattern. The weather has become increasingly extreme, and over 120 tornadoes recently struck the U.S. Midwest. Texas is on fire and suffering through an extreme drought. And where there aren't fires and droughts, there are floods. And this is only the beginning. Now watch for more freak weather over the next 18 months. And the silence of the...
is
another one. Colony collapse disorders.
The failure of nuclear science, the
Fukushima,
vicious
pursuits of WikiLeaks in an age of rampant deceit. There is no room for the truth. So those who tell the truth are viciously pursued as they are criminals.
The rise of the police state, the increasing frequency of food shortages, the runaway destruction of the world by energy companies, the continued GMO contamination of our planet, the tyranny and criminal crackdowns targeting real food, the escalation of the counterfeiting of the money supply, the plummeting intelligence of the masses, the complete and utter fabrication of the mainstream news, the ongoing pharmaceutical pollution of our world, the radioactive contamination of the global food supply.
Yep. And it's accelerating, too. He says December 2012 may be a useful date as some sort of midpoint in the crisis, or perhaps as a trigger date for some future acceleration. But make no mistake, we are already living in a collapse of the modern world, and you have a front row seat.
Just Leo has to check and see if our next guest is waiting.
Okay, yes, I forgot. I'm usually on at the 9:30. I forgot it was on early tonight.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we have our next guest waiting, so...
Anyway, Johnny, we appreciate you being on at short notice there.
We thank you very much. And we look forward hoping your computer is clear and free next week and you can be with us.
Okay, and there's one real quick to say, if you want to check more about what I was saying about the military using weather as a weapon, there is if you go to Phil Schneider, he did a lecture in 1995 on deep underground military bases and the black budget. Deep underground military bases and the black budget, if you can remember all that.
So folks can check that out, and we look forward to talking with you next week.
That's great. I appreciate being on your show and been listening in. Thank you very much, and goodbye, everybody.
Okay. Thanks, John, and good night. And now we have the introductory music for Woody in the Ring, if you can find that, Leo. Into the ring with Woody.
Thank you, Lila. Your introduction is almost as good as my intro music.
Well, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, last week's NFL draft, the NBA playoffs, and, of course, some baseball. Okay, as we all know, last week was the NFL draft. I thought I'd just run down a few of the local teams and how they made out with their picks. In the NFC East, we have the New York Football Giants. Overall, they pulled themselves an A. They drafted this kid, a cornerback, Prince Amakimara. I believe I pronounced that correctly. He's quite a cover guy. He's definitely the key. Not the key to this draft. The key to this draft is probably the defensive tackle, Marvin Austin. Guy's a little bit of a roughneck, and maybe, you know, Justin Tuck can show him the way. Giants also grabbed themselves a receiver, Jarrell Jennigan. He's a return man, and he can scare someone other than the Giants fans themselves. So the guy's kind of quick. You got to like that. They also picked themselves up an offensive right tackle, James Brewer. And he's got left tackle feet, so you got to like that. So, you know, because the Giants' offensive line is kind of getting old. They play great as a group and stuff, but you've got to infuse some young blood into that group. So that's got to be done. Washington Redskins, a team known, you know, owner known just to spend a lot of money on free agency, not known for, you know, making some great drafts. I mean, they pretty much pulled themselves a B. They got a nice outside linebacker by the name of Ryan Kerrington. Guy's a good pass rusher. He picked up a nice wide receiver, a kid by the name of Hankerson. He's got size, and he's got some very big hands, which is fantastic when it comes to, you know, catching a football. So we'll see. A lot of Cowboy fans out there. Cowboy fans didn't really do all that much. They pretty much got themselves a C. They added a tackle, Tyrone Smith, to their offensive line. And they got themselves a guard, David Arkin. But another sideline to sideline inside linebacker, Bruce Carter, but he had an ACL issue. And they also grabbed a running back, DeMarco Murray, to pay behind Felix Jones, who has an awful lot of miles on his legs and has definitely lost a step. So, you know,
no,
we'll see.
Still there. Wait, Peter, you there?
Yes, I am.
Peter?
Is there a problem?
Maybe he dropped his phone.
Or
Peter, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, we couldn't hear you.
So I've been talking and you can't hear me.
Now we can. Just
for the last 30 seconds.
For 30 seconds it was that we couldn't hear you. So just...
It sounds like you dropped, you know.
Okay, just keep talking now. It's all right.
What was the last team that you heard I reviewed?
We went to the C that you had for that team, and you talked about two people.
The Cowboys. That was the last team you heard?
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's just move on to the NFC North. My Chicago Bears, they picked up a nice offensive line guy. He's a tackle guard, Gabe Kemery. He'll probably keep Jay Cutler upright. As you know, Cutler gets sacked. Not a great deal, but definitely more than other quarterbacks. And, you know, we want to keep this guy healthy. Cutler is definitely the key to winning games. And if the Bears are going to get to the Super Bowl, you got to keep Cutler upright. So we'll have to wait and see how that happens. They also traded up for a defensive tackle by the name of Stephen Pay. He can bench press 225 49 times, and he's got some good strength. So he'll replace Tommy Harris, who was in the doghouse anyway. The Bears cut him at the end of the season last season. So we'll see how that goes. Let's hop over to the AFC East. A lot of Patriots fans out there. Obviously, I hate the Patriots and anything to do with the Patriots, anything to do with Boston in general, but you got to give it to Belichick. The guy can draft. He grabbed himself great left tackle, Nate Solder. He probably could be a 10-year starter. He added a couple more cornerbacks and a pair of young running backs. So, I mean, he knows what he's doing. Belichick's definitely very crafty when it comes to drafting. They have some great talent evaluators on that staff. And I guess he'll probably get a pass rusher in free agency. So the guy's pretty crafty. Jets, the New York J-E-T-S, Jets. They got themselves defensive lineman Muhammad Wilkinson. He's a younger and bigger Sean Ellis. Hopefully he'll play more than Ellis did, who was constantly injured. He definitely has double-digit sack ability. They picked up a nose tackle, Kendrick Ellis. He'll definitely be needed to bang heads with the Dolphins rookie center, Mike Pouncey. And he could probably beat Rex Ryan to the fast food table. They got a wide receiver and kick returner by the name of Jeremy Kerley. That means probably Brad Smith could be gone. So we'll see how that works out. Any other teams that are of interest to anyone in the area? A lot of Steeler fans. So we'll talk about, you know, they always get in the Super Bowl, so a lot of people like the Steelers. They picked up a defensive end, Cam Hayward. He's a prototypical 3-4 Steelers end as Aaron Smith and Brett Keisel grow long in the tooth, so definitely be a replacement kind of guy. They got a versatile offensive tackle, Marcus Gilbert. He's a 6'6", 330-pound buddy of Pouncey there, who's in Florida. So he can step in for Fossil, Flozell Adams. You know, so definitely you know, Steelers always upgrading on their offensive line, which is kind of gigantic. All right. Enough of the football. Let's move on to the NBA playoffs a little bit. I made my picks last week, and I'm pretty much going to stand by them. The Heat did beat the Celtics in the first game. As I said, this is going to be probably the most interesting series, period, you know, whether East or West, just because a lot of big names, a lot of players that people root for and a lot of players that people just can't stand on both teams. So it should be a very interesting series. It would be nice if it goes 7. I think it probably will. I hope the Celtics really can just do it to the Heat. It would be fantastic to see LeBron not go to the finals as he planned to and everything else. So we'll have to wait and see, obviously, you know. The Bulls and the Hawks, I took the Bulls. The Bulls did lose their first game at home, but that's nothing to worry about. This will probably go 6, and the Bulls will probably handle their business. Likewise with the Lakers, I was surprised that the Mavs were able to kind of steal the game on them. But, you know, with Kobe, much like Michael in the past, you have to think that, you know, until he's out, he's never out. So we'll just have to wait and see. But the Lakers will probably take care of the Mavericks. But, again, you know, you never know. It's the playoffs. Moving on to baseball. I've been watching a great deal of Yankees lately. You got to love Colon. The guy was picked off the trash heap. Wasn't even in baseball last year. Went down to the Dominican League. Played on Tony Pena's team. One of the Yankee coaches. And Tony Pena recommended him to Brian Cashman. And the guy was signed. He's basically done nothing since spring but throw strikes. Works really easy. The guy just throws a lot of strikes, which is what you like. And the ball moves, you know, horizontally and vertically. Movement on your pitches. The guy throws strikes. That guy's a pitcher. That's the guy I want on my team. So you really got to like that. Watching Jorge Posada, I'm definitely less than pleased. You know, they say it's an adjustment to become a DH. I don't know. I just don't see it. His bat is obviously just slow. You know, he's batting below the Mendoza line. Sure, he did hit a double the other night and brought a couple of runs in, but few and far between. I personally think it's time to maybe go to Eric Chavez a little more often in the DH spot. You just can't afford to give up at-bats. You just can't. I mean, you feel like you're giving up an at-bat all the time. And every time Chavez is in, he does something. So you got to like that. Nick Swisher's kind of coming out of it. Granderson's been on fire. So, I mean, the Yankees are starting, they're starting to come around. Guys are starting to hit. Derek Jeter, not so much. I still look at Jeter, and I'm like, wow. Every time we're in a spot and Jeter comes up, I am thinking something not good is going to happen. You know, he's going to hit into another double play, or he's going to strike out or whatever, or he's going to hit one of those lousy ground balls that just barely gets out of the infield. It just manages to be a hit. I don't even know. I personally, I wouldn't count it as a hit, but they're hits. But some of the stuff he's getting for hits is just, man. I think he's batting like 260, but to me it looks like more like 230 or 220 because some of those hits are just really garbage. But Soriano, the guy who was picked for a setup man, according to him, he's not really all that comfortable yet. I'm not exactly sure. Apparently, he needs more of the roar from the crowd to really get into it, to imagine that the eighth inning is the ninth inning. And this is just something that he said in an interview the other day that I happened to hear. You know, he said the fans kind of get crazy when it's the ninth, and you know that it's over and blah, blah, blah. I just don't understand it. Throw strikes, dude. No matter what inning it is, throw strikes. Shouldn't matter whether it's the eighth or the ninth or the sixth. Your job is to throw strikes. So throw strikes. Speaking of throwing strikes, Phil Hughes has taken any number of tests and nothing has shown up. This is really kind of weird. Take a lot of tests. I noticed that none of them are in New York. Where are all the good doctors? Are they out of New York? Because all these tests that these guys are going for, like in Colorado, Alabama, I mean, it's weird. You don't see them like getting any tests done in New York. It's kind of weird, but whatever. A couple guys that are coming back. Jason Bay is coming back for the Mets. He's not hitting all that much, but he really needs to get his bat going. And a guy from the Mets that might actually see a little bit of daylight this year is Carlos Santana. He's been out for quite some time. He's definitely the Mets' best pitcher going, and it would be nice if he could at least get a few games in by the end of the year, and then we would have him for next year. The Mets are in last place. They're obviously not going anywhere. Probably going to be a fire sale at the break. I would think Carlos Beltran will be heading to greener pastures with his bat. I would think K-Rod might be heading to greener pastures with his closing ability or maybe as a setup guy somewhere. I mean, just, you know, we'll just have to wait and see. But I think it's going to be real interesting to see, you know, what Mets are no longer Mets after the All-Star break. Red Sox still kind of faltering. You know, they win a few games, they lose a few games. I don't think they've really gotten their act together yet. It'll be interesting to see. I think a lot of games that they've lost now are going to come back to haunt them at the end of the season. You know, you can't just give away games like Baltimore, 2 out of 3 here, 2 out of 3 there. I mean, you just can't give up junk games to garbage teams. It's a long season, but all those wins and losses just really add up. And when you're out like 5 games or whatever, you're like, you're wondering how I'm going to catch up these 5 games. It's harder than you think. Good news for the Tampa Bay Rays. Their third baseman and kind of like team leader, Evan Longoria, is back in the lineup. He was lost for a while. Guy's definitely got a great bat, you know, so that's good for them. Again, I mean, frankly, I don't think they're going anywhere this year. You know, it's going to come down to the Yankees and the Red Sox and maybe even the Blue Jays. We'll have to see. People are talking about Baltimore, but that's just some rah-rah stuff. You know, Buck Showalter has him, you know, playing tougher baseball. But, I mean, if you just don't have the talent, you don't have the talent. So, I mean, that's just what it is. Baseball's a long season. And over a long season, talent usually prevails. However, in a short series, whoever's hot prevails. That's what's kind of interesting about baseball. So not the best team doesn't always win the World Series because, you know, the playoffs, hey, man, whoever's hot. You know, it's not like basketball, you know, where stars, you know, shine no matter what. And you get the matchups and everything else. Baseball is a lot different, you know. A lot about pitching and some big hits and stuff. But okay, that's it for this week. Shout out to all my woodheads out there. Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS. That's it. Enjoy the warm weather, and let's hope more comes this way.
Before you end, Woody, do you have any thoughts on the Derby?
Yes. I certainly do have thoughts on the Derby. Put your money on the long shot because they're all dumb horses. You never know which one's going to come in first. You know, they're all, you know, this one's favorite, that one's favorite. Go with the long shot. That's what I say.
Okay, I'll remember that when I go to the betting booth.
please,
thank you very
please
much.
Do. And remember, I certainly don't endorse any type of gambling.
I'll remember that. Thank you, Woody.
Thank you.
Good night. Take ownership of this homegrown commodity and facilitate system learning that could help solve larger global drug world problems. Marijuana use is illegal throughout many countries of the world for reasons that are not clear. The book is important because it provides scientific critique of the medical benefits of marijuana in the light of social, political, and legal hysteria that have been attached to it. Cannabinoids, as Philip Smith of the Drug War Chronicle puts it, is Chris Fitchner's eye-grabbing term for managing our relationship with cannabis in order to move from pot prohibition to regulation. Jettison the M word. Acknowledge that cannabis is a highly valued, homegrown American commodity, and get on with the task of managing its commercial integration into the economy. Why not generate new tax revenue and create opportunities for American entrepreneurs to enter the global medical cannabis market? Cannabinomics is not a medical handbook, a drug war treatise, or an economic model, so much of a work of patient and public policy advocacy. It looks at real-world medical cases, recent trends in successful policy reform, drug war costs, and potential economic benefits of cannabis change. Brilliantly, Dr. Fitchner examines, then debunks, many of the common misconceptions about marijuana, from medical resistance to revolution, from drug war prohibition to public health, from economic reefer madness to recovery, trajectories into public policy converging toward regulation and economic integration of the herbal cannabis trade. Beneath the furious roil of the economic crisis, a national conversation has not been so quietly begun about the irrationality of our drug laws, yes, the incongruity of our political policies that legally prohibit individuals from gaining access to natural plant material they find indispensable for relieving debilitating systems borders on the absurd. The conversation is going on in state legislatures like New York's, where the draconian Rockefeller drug laws are up for review. In other states, from California to Massachusetts, various forms of marijuana decriminalization are being enacted.
The state-level medical cannabis movement is growing rapidly. But California is the only state to allow for medical health applications or mental health applications until New Mexico specifically included post-traumatic stress disorder
on its
list of acceptable indications of medicinal use of herbal cannabis. Among the many interesting ideas in cannabinomics, Fitchner, who began his career treating combat veterans with post-stress syndrome in the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, suggests that PTSD may be a disorder which herbal cannabis can provide broad-spectrum symptom relief. And he makes this suggestion after a very thorough discussion of how even with FDA-approved medications like Zoloft and Paxil, it is rare to see the full spectrum of PTSD symptoms respond to treatment with just one medication. Fitchner's extended discussion of evidence-based practice is, in this context, is just one example of the kind of rigorous analysis cutting across medicine, science, ethics, and philosophy that established this work as a unique book of our time.
There are also more puckish signs of zeitgeist shift. All polls conducted on behalf of cannabis usage show a public obsessed with the legalization of marijuana and its medical use. Moreover, there is an enormous potential windfall in the taxation of marijuana. It's estimated that pot is America's largest cash crop, and potential annual revenue estimates range from $14 to $40 billion. A 10% pot tax would yield $1.5 billion in California alone, and that's probably a fraction of the revenues that would become available and of the economic impact, with an estimated 36,000 to 58,000 new jobs in California in agriculture, packing, marketing, and advertising, a veritable marijuana economic stimulus package.
But there are still bigger issues of economy and simple justice, especially on the sentencing side. It's increasingly clear that the criminalization of marijuana creates more problems than it solves. The cannabis prohibition deprives needy individuals of medicinal benefits, unnecessarily creates crimes and criminals, fuels the black market, and deprives the mainstream economy of important taxable revenue. The U.S. is by far the most criminal country in the world, with 5% of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners. We spend $68 billion per year on corrections, and one-third of those being corrected are serving time for nonviolent drug crimes. We spend about $150 billion on policy, policing and courts, and 47.5% of all drug arrests are marijuana-related. That is an awful lot of money, and most of it non-federal. That could be spent on better schools or infrastructure, or simply returned to public.
Before you go any further, let's check and see if our guest has called in. So be patient with us for a second, folks, while we go to our switchboard and see if our guest is ready for us.
Yes,
and there he is. Let's
let's
get him on the air.
Hello.
Good evening, Doc. How are you?
Good.
Hello.
How are you, Leo?
Good.
Fine.
My co-host is with me. Her name is Lila.
Good evening, Dr. Fisher. It's nice to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be on the show.
And we were just reading some information that your publicist sent, very, very interesting. And my first question to you was, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I've been a practicing psychiatrist for some 20 years or so, and for a good part of my career, most of which has been spent in Illinois, I have done taken on administrative roles. So I've been a chief of psychiatry in the VA, and I've been a chief psychiatrist for the Illinois State Hospital System. And then from 2003 to 2005, I was the state mental health director. And as the state mental health director, I had an opportunity to come into contact with a lot of advocacy organizations, many of which were focused on mental health issues, but some were focused on developmental issues, others focused on general medical concerns. And one of the groups that really engaged me during that time was a group, actually a coalition of groups that were working to try to pass a medical marijuana law in Illinois, medical cannabis law, and that was I really first came to my attention in probably 2003, and they had asked me if I would, put a short white paper in front of try to get that to the governor's office to influence consideration of how the leadership would position itself in terms of whether to support that type of initiative in Illinois or not. And so what I decided to do was to really expand my reading about marijuana out of just pretty much what I had been taught about it up to that time, which pretty much comes in the form of teaching in the substance abuse course. We tend to think of it as a substance of abuse, but I really began digging into some of the historical and anecdotal information and also talking to consumers at that time. One who was very influential, whom I write about in the book, was Julie Falco from Illinois, who's been very outspoken about her multiple sclerosis, about the many medications that she's been on to treat that, and about how she discovered that use of edible cannabis in the form of brownies. She has three of those a day, and I can't tell you what specific strain or anything about, you know, quantitative about it, but you know, she's worked with a group that grows that and provides that for her in Illinois, where it's not legal to do so, but she's been an outspoken advocate because what she found was that when she used the cannabis on an edible basis, she doesn't smoke it at all, but when she used the cannabis as an edible, she found that it helped the full spectrum of her symptoms in multiple sclerosis, which otherwise required three or four or five different medications to treat. So she found that it relaxed her muscles, decreased her pain, it made it so that she didn't have to take Tylenol with codeine as often, and when she did take it, it was more effective. It actually improved her bladder control, which is also a problem in multiple sclerosis. And multiple sclerosis is also associated with mood changes. So she found that it, you know, it's not surprising. You know, that's one of the reasons people use marijuana is because it has a mood elevating effect. She found that it elevated her mood, not to the point where she was impaired and you know, and acting, you know, odd in any way, but actually just felt better and didn't need to take the antidepressant that had been prescribed for her, which caused a lot of side effects. So she was able to find that by using herbal cannabis on an edible basis, she was able to use her pain-relieving medicines more modestly, and when she used them, you know, more selectively, more sparingly, they worked better, and she didn't have as many side effects from them. So it was that story, which I write about in detail in the book, as well as a number of others, that that really stimulated, prompted my own reading about it, and I decided to put together a summary to run through the Department of Human Services, where I worked in Illinois at that time, for consideration that the administration, you know, might support the passage of that type of law, which, you know, it didn't at that time, but, you know, they did take note that there was some support for it in the Department of Human Services. So that's how it all got started. And later, when I left the state directorship, I decided to take some of the thoughts that I had pulled together and to write a book.
Well, certainly it sounds like your book would be required reading for any state legislators or governors. Just from reading what Eileen had written in the promotion about your book, seems like you have a great argument for the legalization, not only because of the medical benefits, but for the tax benefits.
Yeah, well, what I argue in Cannabinomics, you know, so the overview really is that we're at a point in time now. You know, many people have compared our current economic situation to the Great Depression, right? We've heard that over and over again. And, you know, what happened in 1929 was the stock market crashed, and what happened in 1932 and going into 33 was that alcohol prohibition was repealed, and, you know, it was repealed for some of the same reasons that I argue in Cannabinomics that we should look at repeal of cannabis prohibition. I mean, for one, there was a lot of violence associated with the illegal alcohol trade. But in addition, you know, the bootlegging. But then, in addition, you know, it was poorly regulated. It wasn't regulated at all at that time. So, you know, it was possible to get much more dangerous forms of alcohol than are available now. And alcohol is certainly dangerous enough as it is now. One of the interesting things is what people would call big alcohol. Alcohol supporters in California, the alcohol industry certainly pumped some money into opposing Proposition 19, and also I think lobbied with you know, some of the law enforcement organizations, sort of to try to make the point that, you know, well, we're already having problems with alcohol. Why would we want to add one more substance that's going to create problems? And you hear that argument a lot. They'll say, well, it's too late for alcohol. That's already out of the barn, but why should we add one more substance? Well, maybe the reason to add one more substance is so that people could choose something safer because it doesn't do nearly as much harm as alcohol does. So, I mean, so there's a public health issue as well. So what my book argues is that you've got a growing medical movement as the first policy trajectory. The second trajectory is you've got a growing recognition that the drug war per se, the drug war itself is a public health problem, whether you're talking about the violence associated with the Mexican drug war or whether you're talking about having alcohol and marijuana handled the way they are in our society and the resulting many problems that you see with alcohol use that might be avoided if some people used cannabis instead. And then third is the economic situation, where there's a certainly everybody, whether you're on the right or the left, you know, whether your interest in this has to do with states' rights or whether it has to do with regulation for the sake of protecting the consumer, you know, whether you're on the right or the left, it doesn't really matter. You know, everybody can agree that we're at a point in time where we need to recognize new value in the economy and not waste money on fruitless or failing strategies for managing commodities. And I would argue that herbal cannabis is certainly an American commodity. I mean, it's grown in every state. You know, it's consumed widely. Some economic analyses have suggested that it is a bigger cash crop than corn and wheat combined. And in California, it's known to beat grapes as far as a cash crop. So when you put all that together, there's got to be a better way to manage manage it.
Well, I just wanted to mention your second point, which was you were talking about it's safer than alcohol. But the people in the prevention industry, they very much label marijuana as a gateway drug. And how do you respond to that?
Well, you know, they need to first of all say what they mean by the gateway drug. Usually when you try to pin people down, particularly in the substance abuse field or in the prevention field, they'll end up saying, well, it's a gateway drug for some people, and what they by which they mean, well, that was the first psychoactive substance they used, and then they went on to harder drugs. First of all, the vast majority of people who use herbal cannabis do not go on to harder drugs. The vast majority don't. That was certainly recognized by the Netherlands when they made their decision to decriminalize it. And, you know, the strategy, the thinking behind that was to separate the markets so you didn't have to go to the same person for herbal cannabis as you did for heroin or other hard drugs. And I think that, marijuana is certainly a gateway drug in one sense. It's a gateway to the criminal justice system because we've defined it that way. We've made it a gateway to the criminal justice system. We've electively criminalized large numbers of ordinary people because of their use of cannabis. So, in that sense, that's the only sense in which it's a legitimate gateway drug. There are some statistical analyses, some very sophisticated statistical studies that will say, when you've controlled for everything, there is some unexplained variance that leaves room for the possibility of something like a gateway drug. But first of all, that unexplained variance is not very much. It's not very strong, and it certainly is not evidence enough to establish something as the gateway concept as a theory that would be that would really be able to stand on its own two feet in terms of arguing that marijuana really, because of the nature of the substance itself, opens the door to harder drugs. I mean, I would argue that it's far more likely that alcohol is actually a gateway drug in the sense that, you know, it's legal, so it's not a gateway to illegal drugs. You don't have to go to the dealer to get it. But it certainly impairs judgment very profoundly in many people who use it excessively.
And it's addictive. It's an addictive drug.
Well, it's one of the most dangerous and addictive substances available to us. It's probably the most dangerous one. I mean, I suppose you would say, well, you know, maybe with the exception of tobacco, but certainly withdrawal from alcohol can be lethal. And alcohol damages virtually every organ system in the body, and it causes numerous kinds of cancer, of course, as tobacco does. There's very little evidence for that kind of thing with cannabis or marijuana.
I think that's exactly right. I thought I was listening recently, in the last few weeks actually, they've come out with new studies about marijuana curing cancer, okay, brain tumors, neck tumors, these kind of things, I just saw several things on it within the last couple of weeks, and there's one I think on your site, Human Solutions, I believe it is.
Yes.
It's connected to your cannabinomics.com, and it said that there was a doctor there, and he had about a 15-minute thing, and he was talking about the cure of cancer. And how he thought that they knew about it for the last 40 years.
Yeah.
They knew that it cured cancer. And he called this genocide. He said
genocide
didn't allow this stuff on the market.
Well, you know, the advocates for medicinal cannabis access, you know, have a lot of different ideas about what it's good for. And there are some people who have argued on the basis of anecdotal data and some basic science research that there's reason to believe that it is helpful for some forms of cancer. I mean, there's probably, you know, there's research out there that you have to look for. As far as the kind of thing that you know, I look to, I'm a psychiatrist, so I, you know, my area of practice is limited to people with, you know, psychiatric problems. But, you know, even if I were an internist and I more routinely dealt with treatments for, or an oncologist who more routinely dealt with treatments for cancer, you know, we always tend to go first to those treatments that are most established, those for which they're FDA approved, for which, you know, there's good double-blind placebo-controlled studies, good scientific experimental studies that show that drugs or pharmaceuticals work in large numbers of patients. Those kinds of studies have not been done in most areas for herbal cannabis, although there's some areas where those studies have been done. So I wouldn't necessarily, you know, I wouldn't jump on the bandwagon to myself to start arguing that it cures cancer. You know, I'm not saying that it doesn't. The reality is I don't know whether it does or not. But what I'm referring to mainly is that when you go looking for an elevation in the incidence of cancer among marijuana smokers, and now we're talking about smoking it, and, you know, of course, that's the thing that everybody thinks about when you mention marijuana, although its medicinal use is possible in many other forms, edibles, tinctures that are solutions or extracts that will be sprayed under the tongue. It can also be vaporized, which doesn't burn the plant material, which may hold some of the harmful you know, tars that emerge from it. But when you go looking, even in marijuana smokers, you go looking for that relationship to cancer. The studies that did find that kind of relationship, and there are not very many of them, but those that did often did not control adequately for alcohol and tobacco use. When you look at the better studies, the ones that have larger numbers of people and that have controlled for whether somebody is a tobacco or alcohol user, what you find is, you know, one of the studies from 2005 or 2006 that looked at about over 2,000 people did not find any significant relationship at all. And a more recent study that came out of the Boston area that was done in actually it was a collaborative study, so it involved others besides Boston, but one of the main centers was Boston. Might have been Tufts. I'm not sure about that. But it was a study that came out in the summer of 2009 that looked at the incidence of head and neck cancer among marijuana smokers and others. And what that study found, which is quite interesting, was that the incidence of head and neck cancer, it was actually squamous cell carcinoma, so it was a particular type of head and neck cancer, was lower in those who were marijuana smokers than the others. So, you know, we can speculate about why that is. You know, I don't think we have a good working hypothesis. I mean, I could speculate for you about why that is. I mean, if I were to do so, I would say that perhaps the tars that are generated when you burn plant material, and we know that those tars are carcinogenic. You know, that is, they can cause cells to become malignant. For cigarette smokers, perhaps those tars flourish in the presence, or the malignant cells flourish, you know, under the influence of the tars in the presence of nicotine. But in the presence of cannabinoids from herbal cannabis, perhaps they do not flourish. And in fact, there's some experimental evidence for that, because there's some experimental evidence that in the presence of cannabinoids, a phenomenon called cell apoptosis is increased. What cell apoptosis means is when you develop mutant cells, the kind that go on to turn into cancer cells and become tumorous, those kinds of cells have a natural course that leads to their, you might say, suicide or cell death, and that's what's called apoptosis. It seems that some exposure to THC and possibly other cannabinoids seems to retard that process, whereas exposure to nicotine has been shown to increase the blood supply to breast cancer tumors, you know, and other forms of cancer as well. So, I mean, it could be that it's not so much just the smoking. Yes, the smoking, heavy smoking, is going to be harmful in any case. I mean, at least, it, you know, heavy smokers, even of marijuana, are going to be more likely to develop bronchitis than non-smokers. But when you ask the question about cancer, it may be that the compounds in cannabis are inherently protective against it, whereas the ones in tobacco are not. But that's pure speculation, and I'm not arguing that anybody should take that as a fact.
Actually, I read recently that there was a connection a study done that smokers who smoke pot as well as smoke tobacco live longer and healthier than those who just smoke
tobacco.
Tobacco, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's not surprising at all to me, based on the literature that I've seen. I mean, literature that I've read, it doesn't surprise me.
It was quite significant, too. There was also one other study that, one other thing that I wanted to mention, but I wanted to ask you about, because I was in the renewable energy field, okay, as far as renewable energy or renewable products, the many products that come from marijuana, not only for medical purposes, but also for its fiber,
hemp.
Hemp, of course, its fiber, and its resin, all right?
Yes.
That is on par, and its liquid, all right, is actually can produce, was proven that it could produce a high-powered octane gasoline type of thing. Okay.
Yeah, industrial. I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
And I was just going to mention that back in 1937, when it was banned because of the major oil companies that were involved then. Okay, and pharmaceuticals, right? We're both backed by the Hearst Industries. All right.
Yeah.
We're very much afraid that they had large investments, but when they found they developed the harvester, the hemp harvester,
yeah,
right, back then, and it was actually on the cover of Popular Mechanics,
yeah,
right? They had actually invented a hemp harvester,
mm-hmm,
and they could make,
yeah,
hemp this thing extremely efficient. At that point, that's when they came in and said, oh, it's a hallucinogenic,
Well, you know, it's characteristic.
Also, the second, what took its place in the medical field was aspirin.
Yeah.
All right. For the painkiller factor. Right.
Well,
aspirin became a very once they took marijuana off the approved medical medicines. Then they developed aspirin, became the second, the most popular pain reliever.
Yeah. Well, certainly there was a convergence of a variety of economic special interests around that time. You know, you mentioned several of them. You mentioned Hearst, and of course, you know, the association there is to paper and trees and so forth, and they do, you know, suggest that that cannabis can be used to make paper much more efficiently than forests can. I don't really touch much, just barely, on the industrial use of cannabis, but you're quite right. It's very extensive. There are a lot of potential products that could come from that. I don't really talk much about that in cannabinomics, but your point is very well taken. The thing that I do wonder about is, it seems from reading, you know, some of the historical accounts that it's not clear at all that Congress even knew that they were voting cannabis out when they did this. I mean, because marijuana was a name that was very actively, developed by Harry Anslinger in terms of really branding. Essentially, Anslinger spearheaded, he was the director of the Bureau of Narcotics. He essentially spearheaded the rebranding of herbal cannabis as marijuana. And then they made marijuana illegal, and then, well, they didn't make it illegal. They just made it hard to access, except with a lot of paperwork for doctors to prescribe it and so forth. But in the process, it became very difficult to access herbal cannabis. And up till that time, herbal cannabis wasn't considered to be as good a pain reliever as morphine, for example. But it was known to be helpful for menstrual cramps and for migraines. And, you know, you read the early 20th century medical textbooks, you'll see a lot of references to the use of herbal cannabis for some of those things.
Now, what's your position on, obviously, you're for the legalization of cannabis. Would you support the legalization of all drugs?
Well, I think, first of all, in general, I tend to shy away from the term legalization because I find that it tends to be a polarizing term, and people dismiss what you say as you're a legalizer. And you can say, well, this is just semantics. I kind of say, you know, we ought to tax and regulate it. But semantics, you know, of our vocabulary plays a big part in shaping our perception. So I tend to stay away from that. But more importantly, and more to your point, I think you know, there's a lot of people who would make a case that we ought to handle a lot of drugs differently. The thing I don't like about these legalization discussions is, first of all, what do people mean when they say drug legalization, legalize all drugs? First of all, most drugs are legal. You can get them either by prescription from your doctor at the pharmacy, or you can get them over the counter. Most drugs are legal. It's a few select, you know, ones that have been selected that are, you know, determined to have no medical value and made illegal. The problem is that wherever you draw the line between the ones that have medical value and don't, it's pretty clear that cannabis is on the other side of that line, that it's in the wrong schedule right now. I mean, that's pretty clear. So, and the other issue is, I think, that because cannabis is so widely used and so widely grown in the United States, I think that you know, as a policy or social experiment, I think we would do well to apply ourselves to figuring out how to manage that commodity, see what we learn from it, so that maybe that can inform our approach to how we deal with other substances. I mean, we've got, you know, there's a lot of talk about the opium trade in connection with Afghanistan, a lot of talk about coca in connection with South America. All these drugs, in one way or another, come across the Mexican border. But at the same time, you've got, you know, some 10 million people, estimates have, you know, suggest worldwide, that are lacking adequate pain medications. Many of them are in Africa, suffering from HIV disease, from AIDS.
Yeah.
And we don't have enough pain medications for some of those folks. Why can't we go about, you know, finding some ways to better manage the opium trade so that we can turn, you know, what is perceived now as, you know, as a curse into something of economic value. But I think we get ahead of ourselves when we start talking about legalizing all drugs, because we need to start with at the obvious place, with one that is not where it ought to be in terms of how we think about the management of these issues. And clearly herbal cannabis needs to be managed differently. And it, you know, and so that's, I would argue that we start there, we learn from that, and we move on to other issues from there.
But they have known that cannabis cures cancer for the last 40 years. They've known this, right? And yet they refuse to legalize it. They refused to talk about it until about 10 years ago, all right? 10, 15 years ago, when they started to legalize it in different states. But it hasn't caught on. I wanted to ask you before we end, because I read this maybe 10 years ago, that as of that date, there were estimated 70 million people that were using marijuana on a regular basis. Do you have any statistics on if that's increased or decreased or?
What I can tell you is that it tends to fluctuate. It goes up for a while, then it goes down. It goes up again. There's some suggestion that it goes down in it does tend to fluctuate over time, and there was one, you know, some have claimed that the approval of its use medically in some states has been associated with a greater incidence of use on the part of teenagers, but the data that I have seen suggests that if not going down, the rate, the trajectory of the curve that, say, might be going up has actually flattened off in those states that have approved it medically. So, in other words, approval of medical use does not seem to be associated with increased use in adolescents in those states that have approved it medically. So I don't think we can conclude anything about an overall trend. I think it goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down. That's pretty much my understanding of the data at this point in time.
How can our listeners get your book?
Well, the website's the easiest place to find it. It is an Amazon.com powered website, so you can go to Amazon to get it. But it'll route you to this site. The easiest way to get it is go to www.cannabinomics.com, which is CannabinomiCS. www.cannabinomics.com. It can be ordered there.
And I think if any of our listeners, when they get the book and they read it, they should forward it to their state legislature, to their representatives and senators, and maybe it'll help cause some change in our country about with the laws that we have against it. I know some states are becoming more and more open to medical use and legalization, and maybe your book will be a good catalyst for that happening.
Yeah, we're hoping that it's decriminalized here in the very near future. They've got the bill in the legislature now. So
that would be great. I know that in 2008, Massachusetts decriminalized a very high rate of voter approval on that. I think 5% of the vote, if I'm not mistaken.
It was very high.
Yeah.
And that same year,
Michigan approved a medical law as well. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
So I think we can look forward to more change. I think people are becoming more open to that kind of change, and certainly your book will help with that.
And even in Mass and these other states, they haven't found any increase in crime or juvenile, you know,
corruption,
incarceration.
Do I have time to make one more point?
Yeah, I have about 1 minute.
Yeah, well, you know, as you know, my field is psychiatry, and of course, cannabis use in psychiatry would be one of the areas where you expect it to be the most controversial. We don't have a whole lot of time to talk about that, but what I would say is, the idea that that cannabis use may worsen the course of schizophrenia or even precipitate it for some individuals is often highly emphasized, but it's not the only relevant issue in psychiatry. First of all, there is a relationship there, but it's not at all clear that it's causal. There may be self-medication involved, and it's not a strong relationship in any case. If there is a causal element where use of marijuana hastens the onset of schizophrenia or makes it worse, it's not a strong relationship. But the other thing is that there are areas within mental health where cannabis use may actually be helpful. New Mexico in 2009 became the first state to add an explicit psychiatric diagnosis to its list of problems for which a physician could make a medical cannabis recommendation. And the diagnosis it added was PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder. So we've got a lot of veterans coming back from Afghanistan, Iraq. Historically, we had Vietnam veterans and those from other conflicts that have wanted access to herbal cannabis because they felt that it relieved a lot of their symptoms. It relieved their nightmares, helped them to sleep better, kept them away from alcohol, eased their irritability and their anxiety. And so now New Mexico has a law in place which allows it specifically for PTSD. And, of course, in California, the inclusion clause for mental health is broad enough that it's also possible here in California to recommend it for mental health issues. And I think that's important because I think in the end it ends up that California is the only state that does not discriminate against persons with mental illness for access to herbal cannabis on a medicinal basis. And I think that's very important.
I think it is, too, and I hope that other states follow suit. And we really appreciate that you've written such a book and that you're an advocate for an herb that can improve the lives of many, many people.
I want to thank you so much for being on, and we wish you the best of luck.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I very much enjoyed it.
Well, we appreciate it, and we'd like to have you back again sometime.
Yeah.
Love to do it again. Just let me know.
Okay.
All right, you got it.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you. Take care. Good night.
And that was Dr. Chris Fichtner talking about his book, Cannabinomics, and his argument for the legalization of cannabis.
Yeah, and you can check out cannabinomics.com is where he's got his website. And again, that's CANNABINOMICS, Cannabinomics. And I want to thank everybody. Thank you, Ida, for being such a lovely co-host tonight. And we will be back again tomorrow, same time, same place, with some more earth-shattering news.
Yeah, and thanks for being with us, and have a great night, folks.
Good night, everyone.